Hi, I'm Mike Dilk and you're listening to the Relax Back UK show, the show that explores all kinds of health topics relevant to you, your family and your friends. Each week I talk to expert guests from a range of backgrounds to inform and entertain you. So please do join the Relax Back UK family and stay tuned.
Hi, and thank you for joining me on the Relax Back UK show. This week's topic is pain. We look at many different aspects, including how the weather might affect our experience of pain.
Most patients who suffer chronic pain have very poor, unrefreshing sleep. And if you're compounding that with hot nights, then that becomes more of a problem. You mentioned some of the mood effects. You know, warmth is great. Good weather is great. If you're on holiday, you're expecting it. You can slip into the pool or whatever. But when you're trying to sleep at night or you're in our badly air-conditioned or lack of air-conditioned homes, it's not easy. And so there is a mood element or a change in mood that can occur for some people.
My guest is Dr. Simon Thompson, a consultant in pain management and neuromodulation. We also look at different treatments, including the method of neuromodulation, which involves an implant. So please do stay tuned for a great show. Thank you. I started the chat with Dr. Simon Thompson by first of all asking him about the very fast reactions that we can have to a situation, sometimes before we've even felt any pain. Pain is a good thing and a bad thing. I mean, it stops us doing things that damage us and are frankly a bit silly to do, like, you know, like sticking your finger in the fire, something like that. But something that I've always sort of intrigued me a little bit. We can be so sensitive to some things that our body sort of reacts so quickly before our brain even registers it. I mean, we've all experienced that. We've done something so fast to get ourselves out of the way of whatever it might be, you know, a bus coming straight for us or, you know, just something dropping out of the sky and we react and we get out of the way and we think, goodness, how do we do that? How do we do that?
Yeah, well, it's not just unique to the pain experience. That's also hearing and sight. And the neuroscientists, the more they look into things like sight, it's a lot of it is telling your brain is telling you what you're seeing. And similarly with hearing. But that's a whole more applied area. I think the main thing that you probably want to know about is what's the difference between acute pain and chronic pain?
And acute pain. Yes, certainly. Although before we go on to that, there is other aspects of pain in that pain is not always bad and I'm or a bad sensation. I'm thinking if I go for a little jog and the next day my muscles are a bit achy after doing some exercise, I'm almost a bit smug about that. You know, I'm stiff. I must have done some exercise. It's not quite pain.
Yeah, no, but that's because the pain experience is built up of many layers. So there is the perception of pain, and even your muscles is you have a perception of pain, but then you put a value on it, and you're putting a value on it and saying, "Well, I'm trying to exercise, get myself fitter. I would expect this to happen, therefore I feel good about it." But this is all quite different to the chronic pain experience that many patients suffer from. Where the pain that they experience isn't actually telling them anything that's terribly useful. And so they suffer and experience.
All right. What about, we will get onto that. These just sort of random thoughts, almost random questions I had at the start. You hear about phantom pain. So people that have had a limb amputated or they've lost it in an accident or something, sometimes they still feel pain in that limb. I mean, that's got to be something's gone wrong there. How can that possibly happen?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's so your brain projects a body image, and you can still take away the limb. It's still going to project to your inner, you know, to your consciousness an inner image, and then. Often pain is a balance between excitatory phenomena and inhibitory phenomena.
Right.
And the inhibitory phenomena arise in the central nervous system as well as in the peripheral nervous system. So you take away the peripheral nervous system by doing an amputation, and you can then have uninhibited pain projection from the nerve, from the brain.
Right. And that's a real problem, though, isn't it, for amputees? I mean, it can ruin their life.
Yeah. I mean, we've gone a lot better at it in as much as that it's not like the First World War where experience was ignored. Now that's one of the phenomena that is actually kind of accepted by us all as a society and medically. And that's helpful. And then we've also got a number of strategies that we deploy nowadays to try and help people with that condition.
Okay. I've just another of those sort of questions that popped into my head through a little knowledge is a dangerous thing kind of thing. If you remember something, like you can do a scan of someone's brain and see that part of the brain that deals with memories lighting up. When it comes to pain, there's kind of no pain center in the brain, is there? Like you could stub your toe and it hurts and one bit of your brain lights up, or the next day you could drop a piano on it or something and it hurts in a different part of your brain. Is that right? There's no actual pain center.
Well, we don't really think of centers now. We think of networks. Okay. So there's, there are lots of areas of the brain that are associated with acute and chronic pain. There are people who do an awful lot, and like Professor Irene Tracy, who has done an awful lot of work at University of Oxford and leads a big group that looks at the pain experience in terms of using functional MRI. And, the curious thing about that is that, you can tell somebody you're going to hurt their toe, but without doing it. But just the experience of that can light up the same bits of the brain as if you have hurt their toe. Mm-hmm. So, there's still a lot of that specificity that is still unanswered at the moment.
So does her lab work consist of putting people in MRIs and then subjecting them to various different pains?
It's a very special type of MRI. It's a research tool that she's using. Yeah, yeah. So
Fantastic. Basically,
yeah, she does clinical experiments to try and understand more about the pain experience, yeah.
I mean, pain is certainly subjective. That's what everybody says. And so in generally speaking, can women put up with more pain than men because they have pain, they have pain every month, they have childbirth, etc., or do just us men just kind of whinge a bit more? Is there any truth in this?
I don't think in that, but there are a lot of conditions that are much more common in women. Chronic widespread pain from a condition known as fibromyalgia is about 20 times more common in women than in men.
Right.
I don't think we really think in terms of, tolerance of pain. And that will change from one person to the next. So, the typical one is the soldier on the battlefield who gets shot in the leg but has to get himself off the battlefield to safety, for example. There are various natural mechanisms that suppress that, for example. But again, it comes back to this sort of chronic long-term pain. And really, that's where belief systems and emotions come into the maintenance of the pain and the suffering.
Yeah, so let's look at that. So we've got acute pain is when, you hit your finger with a hammer, ow, it hurts, and then the throbbing stops after a little while. Chronic pain, what is the definition of chronic pain?
Yeah, so chronic pain is pain that's existed for more than 3 months. And why 3 months? Because that's the time for your acute pain, for the injury usually to heal and settle down, right?
Yeah.
As some people say 6 months, but 3 months is generally the definition.
So if pain carries on for that long, so you hit your thumb particularly hard and 6 months later it's still hurting, is that kind of a design fault or has something gone wrong? Because there's no kind of need to feel that pain anymore in the kind of terms of looking after yourself.
Yeah, well, I mean, the fundamental purpose of pain is obviously for you to let's not do that again.
Yeah.
And to learn from the experience. There's also, if you've broken a bone, you don't really want to be carrying on running around. You want to there is this sort of withdrawal component from your usual activity, isn't there?
Yeah.
But you're absolutely right. There are, looking at the underlying mechanisms of why people develop chronic pain there can be reasons for it. So there is the injury to the nerves. So it turns out you can injure your nervous system peripherally. So, mm-hmm. with an injury or even an operation or something like what colloquially known as a slipped disc. And even when that cause of that injury is removed, the pain can continue. And that's typically known as neuropathic pain. The sort of like the arthritis of the knee or the hip, whatever, we call that a nociceptive pain. So that's utilizing, that's what the nervous system should normally do. Mm-hmm. It excites pain fibers within the joint lining that then activate the pain centers. And now there's also this thing known as nociplastic pain. And nociplastic pain is where there is a sensitization of the nervous system that subserves that part of the body.
Okay. So the nervous system there has been kind of switched on lots and lots because it's been hurting. And then for whatever reason, it doesn't seem to switch off.
Turn itself off. Yeah, exactly right. And what's worse is it can also expand and so involve other parts of the body as well.
Really? Well, expand along the nervous system,
within the nervous system. So, are conditions like complex regional pain syndrome, which might start with an injury to, a peripheral limb, but then to say the thumb, but the pain, and you kind of experience it yourself, if you hit your thumb with the hammer, it's not just the thumb that hurts. You start to notice that the forearm hurts as well.
Okay.
Right. And in those sorts of conditions, that it can involve the whole limb.
All right, so it can really spread quite a long way.
Yeah.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
And then, of course, there are things like chronic widespread pain, fibromyalgia, which we think is a disorder of central inhibition. So they have projected pain to all four parts of the body.
Hang on. Say that one, that last one again. You lost me a bit.
Yeah. Well, things like fibromyalgia, which is very common, affects 2% of the population, is where pain is felt widespread, usually in all parts of the body, upper limbs and lower limbs, okay. And so on. And, it has particular characteristics.
And is that's just brought on by bad luck in life or sparked off by an injury?
Nobody really knows. It's like a lot of things. There's probably some kind of genetic, so it's nature and nurture, genetic predisposition. When you go into it, there's usually quite a lot of, into the psychology, people have had quite a lot of adverse childhood events in their lifetime. And so that, sensitizes the central nervous system as well.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. It's rapidly becoming obvious that this is not a simple topic. This is like, we could have a mini series on this.
Absolutely. Yeah. And there should be. Yeah.
Perhaps you want to be careful. I might invite you back for many more chats. But let's sort of park those bits of sort of pain in general and move on, because at the moment, we've had a lot of really hot weather, a lot of heat waves, and that makes people feel grumpy, hot and sweaty, short-tempered. It certainly does to me. How does that affect people's pain? or can it affect people's pain?
Well, the answer is yes, it can. And I think the point is that we're saying that pain is a physical and an emotional experience. And for example, poor sleep go hand in hand with the chronic pain experience. So most patients who suffer chronic pain have very poor and refreshing sleep. And if you're compounding that with hot nights, then that becomes more of a problem. You mentioned some of the mood effects. You know, warmth is great. Good weather is great. If you're on holiday, you're expecting it. You can slip into the pool or whatever. But when you're trying to sleep at night, or you're in our badly air-conditioned or lack of air-conditioned homes, it's not easy. And so there is a mood element or a change in mood that can occur for some people. And
mind you, isn't there a lot of older people will say, oh, God, you know, the colder months are coming. This, my arthritis plays up during the colder months or when it's a bit damper. Is that really true or just something people say?
I think the jury's out on that one. People have tried looking at barometric pressure in people, you know, who claim that they can predict the nature of their pain. I think the other funny thing is when I was asked whether I was happy to contribute to this was, you know, if you said to a patient, a lot of my patients, you know, they've got, you know, maybe disabling back pain, for example, but if they can get away on holiday, they'll often say, well, you know, it was a lot better when I was on holiday. And you kind of think, well, why? And, you know, then they always jokingly say, can't you prescribe a holiday in the Mediterranean, that sort of thing. But there's just as many people with long-term chronic pain in hot countries as there is in cold countries. So it's usually other things. They may be happier because they're away with family. Mm-hmm. They may even be drinking a little bit more, and they may even be a little bit more active. So I'm not advocating drinking alcohol as a treatment of pain. It's just because it's got too many side effects. But, that's the sort of thing that can happen.
Okay, so
it's a many layered experience.
Yeah, all right. So that's very complex. So maybe we should park that to one side as well. I've come across lots of different treatments for long-term pain, and I've spoken to people on this show. You know, some very eminent people, and the one thing that has cropped up a couple of times, and that is medication derived from cannabis, seems to help some people with long-term chronic type pain. Is that something that you've come across or know anything about?
So obviously I come across it because to date there isn't any adequate controlled studies that would show that there is benefit. However, you know, there will be patients who will report some improvement, whether it's a non-treatment effect, if you like, a placebo, or whether it's a real effect, or whether it's helping with their anxiety symptoms that mm-hmm. we've already mentioned. The truth is nobody really knows at the moment. We don't prescribe it in the NHS because it's not got that level of clinical evidence to support. And it's not just its efficacy, it's its safety. And that's the problem. If you're advocating medication that might interfere with people's ability to look after their car if they're driving, or machinery, or their children, and then the risk of these substances getting into the hands of young children, you know, there's definitely an upswing in A&E attendances of children with harmed by finding cannabis at home and so on.
Okay.
So, you know, the jury is still out on that. Obviously, it's being very heavily pushed by the marketing companies who market cannabis. And there are plenty of private doctors who will provide prescriptions, but they're usually very expensive, you know, £500 a month type thing. Mm.
But not something that happens via the NHS as yet.
No, yeah. But I mean, it would do if they could provide the good clinical evidence.
Opioids. Now, that is another painkiller. That's a painkiller that has been used for a long time. That's a treatment that comes with its own issues as well. And I think there's been some real problems in the United States with kind of overuse and people becoming addicted to them. In fact, I came across a statistic which I had to read twice, and this statistic I did get from a popular book. Okay, so this is not from a peer-reviewed paper. This is from a book actually by Bill Bryson. He said between 1999 and 2014, 250,000 Americans died from opioid overdoses. And that seemed like a massive number, but is there a real problem with this?
There is. I don't think it's wrong either. And, you know, it's a massive problem. And there was a time, I'm just trying to think of the dates, but probably in the noughties when, and, you know, Purdue Pharmaceuticals and the like had some support from the American Pain Society's American Academy of Pain Medicine that suggested that the use of opioids in non-cancer pain didn't carry all the risks that we all thought that it would have done, you know, with addiction and so on. And so there was a big push, if you like, initially to, prescribe in non-cancer pain. And then similarly, there was a big pressure in the takeoff of day surgery and more bigger operations. And this idea that nobody should experience unnecessary surgical pain after their surgeries. And so they were prescribed these very strong opioids like oxycodone, OxyContin. And the patients there found that it also helped my back pain. And so they started asking for prescriptions that to be continued for their back pain. Mm-hmm. And then, ran into huge problems, as you say, with tolerance and addiction.
But it doesn't keep working, does it? Like it works on your pain for a bit and then kind of stops after a while. Is that right?
Yeah. And often what you're left with is when patients sort of like have their source, if you like, you know, stopped or, they go into opioid withdrawal, which is a massive stress response, which makes pain much worse and more difficult to deal with.
Oh, God, so it's a vicious circle there.
I very rarely will initiate opioid prescribing. A lot of my work is in trying to support patients in tapering them off them.
Right.
So they often come to my clinic and they're already on strong opioids.
Okay. So you help them. Now, you're a consultant in neuromodulation, is a whole treatment process. Perhaps you can give us an outline of kind of what that is and how it works.
Yeah. Well, neuromodulation is this growing area of medicine. And when it's applied in pain situations, what we're actually doing is applying electrical stimulation to various nerves that are involved in the pain experience. And, it's usually requires an implant. And, you know, typically it's specific to a type of pain. So you heard me speak of neuropathic pain, mm-hmm. which is pain that is generated by the damaged nerves tissue. And similarly, also in nociplastic pain, a peripheral origin. And by stimulating the nerves, you actually turn off the abnormal pain signaling.
It's as simple as a little electric sensation.
There's nothing simple about it.
No.
But for a patient,
I shouldn't have said that.
Yeah, that's right. It demands high quality selection, high quality surgery to put it in. But it's done as a day case in my hands, I will probably implant two or three patients a week these days, and typically it's, as I say, for nerve pain, but there are other treatments around now that stimulates other parts of the nervous system for pain. So, for example, the nerve that supplies some of the core muscles of the low back. Mm-hmm. So that's a treatment that's now we use in back pain only. It's not even nerve pain. It's patients who have a dysfunction of their core muscles of the low back.
All right.
And by stimulating there, we can relieve and restore function of those muscles.
talk a little bit more about the kind of implants that you would do. Like, where do they go? And what? How big are they? What sort of pain do they help with?
Okay, so, I mean, the majority of what I treat is patients with, we nowadays call it persistent spinal pain syndrome, PSPS. So they may or may not have had surgery, for example, to relieve their nerve root pain because of their slip disc, and then they've got recurrence of the pain, or it never really relieved the pain. Where does it go? I mean, basically, the leads are inserted into what's known as the epidural space, which is the fat and blood vessel and nerve-filled column within the spinal bones.
People who have had children will have heard of that.
Yeah, they've heard of that because they've had that space filled with local anesthetic in order to numb the nerves that take sensation from the uterus. What we're doing, we're not trying to do that. We're trying to position our leads over the spinal cord, so that we can create an electrical field that then excites the nerves within the spinal cord.
Okay.
And that has this, yeah. And then the implantable pulse generator is essentially a computer in a can with usually a rechargeable battery is what I tend to use. You can have a non-rechargeable battery, but shorter time. And that usually goes in what I call the loin. So it's under the fat of the loin in the mid-back as well. And then
can you see that? If
they're very thin, yes, you can. If then, you know, got a bit of subcutaneous fat, then you can't really see it. But you do need to feel it because you've got to be able to charge it up. So you put a device over it, and by interferential, it can charge the battery.
So you charge it up in the same way as these fancy phones, and you put your phone or something on the desk and it charges up.
That's it, yeah.
Okay. How often do you have to do that?
Depends on the power of the programs, but it's usually, you know, 2 or 3 times a week, and it takes 20 to 40 minutes.
Okay. So it's like you put a belt on.
You put a belt on, you put the charging device over it, it locates it like a depth charge thing. And it sort of, you know, beep, beep, beep. And when the beeping stops, you know you're over it.
Yeah.
And that's how it does it. And then they have a handheld programmer connected by Bluetooth to the device inside.
Right, that was going to be my next question. Yeah, how do you turn the thing on?
Yeah, well, it's usually on all the time nowadays. And they can, you know, make adjustments to it, go from one. Because what we've learned in recent years is how you talk to the nervous system is also very important. So it's not just what you say. You know, you don't just keep saying the same thing. You might, change the way you speak to the nervous system.
Okay, so when it's on, so it gives different charges at different times. It varies what it does it?
You can, you know, target different parts of the nervous system. You know, if you want more back pain control, if you want more leg pain control, if you want a program that's more comfortable to have on when you're asleep. And the other thing we've discovered in recent times, because when we put it in, we want to make sure we're interacting with the correct nervous system. So as the biomarker is the patient, what can they feel? So we want to make sure that they can feel the stimulation, the tingle in the area of your pain. And we always used to think you always had to have that. Now we've learned you can have silent programs. It's still impacting the inhibitory pathways, but they don't reach consciousness now.
Okay. So when you're putting this thing in, is the patient conscious, and you kind of change the position of the wires and you say, how does that feel?
Yeah. So basically we thread in, the case I did today, you know, 32 contacts, two contacts of 16 each. And then we can, by the computer, we can run a program up and down that to make sure it's in the right place.
So how big is this wire? You say there are 32
like
contacts
a piece
on
of
each
spaghetti,
one.
Like a piece of spaghetti.
How long?
It's about as floppy. I mean, everybody calls it a wire, but it's about as floppy as a piece of cooked spaghetti. But we stiffen it to put it in and steer it into the right place, and then we take the stiffener thing out.
Okay. So how long is this piece of spaghetti that you're feeding in?
Well, 50 centimeters, but what's actually in the epidural space is about 15 centimeters.
Okay. All right.
So you go lower down and then thread it up.
I had the impression that we were talking a tiny little piece of wire, but it's not. It's relatively long, you know, 15 centimeters.
Yeah. I mean, it's very clever how they are made. I mean, there's a huge amount of technology that goes into these devices. And then on top of that, you have to make them MRI conditional. So, you know, nowadays our patients in most conditions can safely have an MRI scan if they needed it.
But, wow. How do you do it? Because it's metallic, isn't it?
Yeah. So it's all about the reverse wiring. And so basically you coil up and you coil back, and then that allows the whatever's induced in one of the coils cancels the other one out.
Wow. Okay. Again, we're going into the realms of very complicated physics now, I would suspect.
Absolutely. There's a hell of a lot to it. I actually had the pleasure of going around the factory that makes all of these things recently.
Okay.
And, and to scale. So, you know, it's a very interesting to see how, you know, the computer boxes are made and how they are safe to be used in humans.
Yeah. So we got the bit of spaghetti wire, which 15 centimeters is the bit that works. It's a bit longer than that because it has to get to the place where the work is done.
Yeah.
The power pack. How big is the power pack? You might have said
I always say it's the size of a man's watch.
Okay. All right.
It gives you an idea of the scale.
All right. Now, so people come in and they have this inserted, put in place by you, and that's a day visit, is it?
Yeah, we do it usually in the morning and they go home at lunchtime.
Wow. Fantastic. Yeah. Now, I have to ask this because it's a medical procedure. Are there any side effects, potentially? Any negative effects?
So which we do an awful lot to mitigate against. I think the main thing that would trouble most people is implant infection. So, you know, if you put any foreign body into somebody, there is always a risk of implant infection. There will be some people who are more at risk because they've got poor immunity, for example. We have a whole sort of way of mitigating and reducing the outcome of that.
It sounds like that this procedure has been done for quite a few people now.
Yeah. So we now in the UK, I helped create it really. We have a national neuromodulation registry. So since 2018, everybody who is asked whether they'd be happy to have their details on the registry, or if not, then we at least register the devices. And I think we've got 5,000 or 6,000 patients now since 2018. We do think that not enough patients get access to this treatment. And so it's probably about only about 5 to 10% of patients who would benefit from this get it. I think the other key thing is that
why is that? Why don't?
Well, that's an interesting thing. So a lot of it is ignorance of where the patients are being looked after, who they are under of the therapy. And then there is sort of like not ignorance of the potential benefits and then also of where to refer. And mm-hmm. And then there is a reluctance by some patients. They don't want to have a foreign body inside them, right. For example, although, you know, they seem to may have had their foreign bodies, you know, with their surgery. But anyway, so there's that. It is something that we are, as those of us who are trying to do something about this. So, you know, I'm involved, for example, in various, in not guidelines, but in recommendations by societies that are important, like the British Pain Society, mm-hmm. try and encourage the doctors who don't do these therapies to recognize patients who would benefit and to encourage them to refer. I've created something called an SCS e-tool. So it's like it helps advise doctors with a few key questions as to whether their patient would be appropriate to have it.
Okay. Excellent. And is it available all over the country on the NHS?
It is, yeah. Yes, it is. There is would be access all over the country. There's three centres in Scotland, only one in Wales at the moment. Strangely, the East and certainly the West Midlands doesn't have any access or very little access to it.
Okay, from your description, it's a relatively quick thing to put in one day. I'm sure you've given the kind of the simplified version of it. But for the NHS, is it a cost-effective treatment? Because, you know, people that are in severe pain, you know, they have to go to the doctor a lot. They can't hold down a proper job quite often, etc. So is it a good cost-effective thing to have done?
Yes, it is. Yeah, so we've shown that it is cost effective. These rechargeable batteries, you know, last 12 years. So usually you get to, you know, if you take into consideration what is the comparator, whether it be drugs or, you know, rehabilitation or even further surgeries, then it's been shown to be cost effective.
Okay.
And usually break even is between sort of 2-3 years. So it's a high investment cost. Yeah. But then after that, as long as you manage things like get them off the medications if they're still on them and that sort of thing, then it's very cost effective. And the rechargeable is even more cost effective.
Okay. Although there are published papers that kind of show
that. Yeah. And so it was all looked at by the National Institute of Healthcare Excellence, NICE, back in 2008. We wouldn't have it unless it was cost effective.
No, I mean, this does sound absolutely fascinating. And I think from what you've said, can turn people's lives around from one of really drudgery to actually back to a life of pleasure again.
But you know what? That's one of the reasons why I still do it, because seeing the patient experience sort of further on down the line when their lives were utterly blighted by their pain, and now they're like, you know, you've given my life back.
Yeah.
You've given my wife's life back, you know. And yeah, we do get some patients who will go back to work. I mean, not heavy manual, but, you know, certainly will go back to work. So they actually do contribute more to society, you know.
And pay some taxes, yeah.
They pay taxes, and, you know, the guilt that patients feel is massive often when they can't contribute, or they can't contribute to their family life, and so on.
Now, this is all very good. If people are listening to this and thinking, right, actually, this sounds like it might be very useful for me or for someone else I know, or they just want to find out a little more, can you suggest some good, solid sources that they can just... I'm talking about for Joe Public here. I'm not talking about doctors, surgeons.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there is a Boston Scientific website, which is a good place they could start.
Control your pain.
Control your pain.
.co.uk.
Obviously, anybody can look at the NICE technology appraisal 159, but it doesn't really tell you where to send patients.
So, Dr. Thompson, thank you very much indeed for taking some time to chat, because I think this is a very useful and interesting topic that can help a lot of people. Thank you very much to my guest on this week's show. That was Dr. Simon Thompson, consultant in pain management and neuromodulation. Thank you to you for listening. And please do remember, if you suffer from lower back pain, particularly if you're sitting at your desk, why not have a look at my website, relaxbackuk.com. You can see all about the back app chair, which has helped hundreds of people who find sitting at their desk just very uncomfortable or very painful. You can apply to try out a back app chair for free going to the website. Once again, that is relaxbackuk.com. So please do join me next week and have a healthy week. Until
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
for listening to the Relax Back UK show. Join me, Mike Dilk, again next week for more fascinating interviews and chat. If you're listening to the podcast version, please subscribe, like, and share it with your family and friends. And have a healthy week. Until next week.